thank you so much for giving us the time to do this.
No, thank you. It honors all ours.
No, no, no. And welcome back to America.
Yeah.
I feel like we've got you for like a nanosecond in between all your travels.
Yeah, no, I'm here. And I travel a lot, but typically within the U.S. But, yeah.
Yeah, that was a big trip. So, John, just tell us when you're ready.
All right, we're rolling. Sounds good.
Okay, good. Rami, you've recently returned to the U.S. from the Islamic World Forum in Doha, Qatar. Can you tell us a little bit about the proceedings there? What captured your attention, and was there anything that happened that surprised you?
Well, as you may know, this was, I believe, the 7th annual U.S. Islamic World Forum in Doha, and put on by Brookings Institute in coordination with the Sabah Foundation and key members of the government in Qatar and other agencies across the world, really. And I think I have been aware of these talks now for some time, but what I was told was unique about this particular experience is something that I felt immediately and was somewhat surprised and impressed by, was the presence and range of voices that were part of the conversation, and particularly in a workshop format, which I think was unique for this conversation. They had, you know, grassroots activists from Senegal, from all the way from Somalia to folks in the subcontinent, to a more inclusion of American Muslims who were also active in a kind of grassroots community organizing context. And I think that combination of voices with the workshop format produced some really inspiring and interesting set of conversations.
What were some of those conversations, and even beyond the conversations, what kinds of things might happen as a result of those connections that you made?
Well, you know, I should also say something else. Yeah, the conversations, and that's not to also lose sight of the kind of the more, you know, the more headline-grabbing components of the convention. I mean, this year, too, the presence of the Secretary of State, Senator Kerry, and then a televised message from President Obama himself announcing the appointment of Rashad Hussein to the OIC, the Organization of Islamic States, our countries in Jeddah, was also a really big part of the kind of the larger kind of context of this gathering. And that was also refreshing on some level. You know, certainly there's always tension and there's always robust debate around some aspects of U.S. foreign policy in that part of the world, and there's certain segments of the Muslim communities that have concern around those policies. But the fact that there was a real, it's been a year, and there was a lot of conversation about to what extent a year after the Obama administration has taken power and has engaged in a very deliberate outreach to the Muslim world and to Muslim communities across the world, how that has changed things, or if it has changed it at all. I mean, there was a lot of conversation about that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was exciting. And I think to your question as to what came out of some of those conversations, I think there was a lot of, I think it was still very exploratory, but people were thinking, at least in the workshop that I was in, which was thinking about a new set of kind of transnational community collaborations. There was lots of conversation about what types of projects could we be collectively engaged in that could actually connect what's happening on the south side of Chicago or in Harlem with community civic projects in Somalia and Senegal. And those types of conversations, I think, were very interesting, and I think allowed particularly the community organizers and activists in the room to really partake in a very active way.
That sounds very exciting. And I want to get to Imam, the group that you run in Chicago, in just a minute. But just to follow up for a second on what you just said. So did you see connections, similarities, differences between, say, a community organizing group in Somalia or Senegal and things that you are doing in Chicago or that some of your colleagues might be doing in New York? Are there some things that just seem universal or transcendent, or are there ways in which you thought, wow, it's really different for me here in Chicago than it is in another country?
Yeah, you know, I think we start with the, we take the difference often for granted. I mean, obviously the context in some of these very, you know, more impoverished communities and, you know, working within societies that don't have such a rich kind of civic sector historically, you take for granted that, that those types of differences between what happens in the States and some of those communities exist. But increasingly, and, you know, of course, you know, we're talking constantly about a globalized and ever interconnected world. The realities of young people across the world, across Muslim communities, increasingly are shaped by some of the same economic, cultural forces and often responding to some of the same really, you know, immediate issues around identity, around need for, you know, opportunity and empowering activities that can both, you know, give those community members a meaningful life trajectory, but also allow them to do so with a sense of dignity around who they are as Muslims. And I found that there was actually much more similarity and, you know, with some of the community organizers in places like Somalia and Senegal and Harlem. And so a lot of the conversation resonated, I think, in ways that, you know, surprised maybe some of the organizers there, but mm-hmm. I think as soon as, you know, there's a grassroots organizing sensibility in this day and age that I think is really global. And part of that sensibility is, look, you know, communities can do things and connect in real engaging ways that aren't always dependent on big state mediating institutions. And there's more opportunities via the web, via, you know, travel and other things these days than there has been in the past. And I think thinking about the possibilities of doing those types of things and making those types of connections through our conversation was, a good part of what we were thinking through.
That sounds very exciting, and it sounds like that there very well may be some tangible follow-up there. I want to just switch for a minute and talk about the organization that you run in Chicago called IMAN, I-M-A-N, which stands for the Inner City Muslim Action Network. You do so many things. It's so inspiring and impressive. You run a community health clinic. You run education programs. You work on criminal justice. You work on public safety. You work with a whole variety of other groups in the Chicago area. You have a project called Muslim Run that's just really, really fascinating. So why don't you just pick one or two of the many, many things you're doing that you would just like to highlight and talk about?
Sure. And just for context, so you know, IMAN now has been an organization in existence for over 13, 14 years. We were formally incorporated in 97. And, you know, while we may seem to have a whole bunch of projects that occasionally could look like we're all over the place, there is a little cohesion to the way we work. And it is, you know, we have set of direct services, you know, which include, as you mentioned, the free community health clinic, career, you know, services, a transitional housing for formerly incarcerated segments of our community. And then the second area is this very important area of organizing and advocacy. And in that area, you know, IMAN has over the years really advocated around key social justice issues that particularly impact low-income communities in the inner city. And whether that is the, you know, criminal justice issues, housing, education, or even issues around immigration and national security, we have been, you know, on the forefront of trying to make sure that as we allow the voice of particularly American Muslim activists and other Muslim activists to be at the table, that we do so out of a siloed context, and we do that in unison with other particularly, you know, disenfranchised or other vulnerable segments of the inner city. So we, you know, are very much oftentimes, you know, working in alliances and coalitions. But just to be specific, you mentioned, for instance, one of our more recent campaigns is entitled Muslim Run, and it's a question mark, quite frankly, and it's called a campaign of health, wellness, and healing. And in it, we're probably taking on a very sensitive issue, but one that we kind of feel like our organization is well positioned to take on, and that is the ownership of liquor stores and other types of businesses in Black communities, predominantly from Arab Muslim immigrants. And the campaign seeks to address the very real issue of food deserts, and since we have a general concern around health and wellness in the inner city and see food access as a justice issue. But also in doing so, we're really addressing the ethnic, racial tensions, disconnections between predominantly Arab store owners and Black community residents, and trying to find ways to be very honest and open about the very racialized sets of conversations that need to take place to talk about the tension and to put forward an alternative set of, you know, practices and business models that can produce better relations between the community.
Wow, that sounds incredibly exciting. Well, we'll keep our CAP listeners and readers posted on our web about that.
Yeah,
I think we're going to actually focus on Muslim Run in particular because it's a really important effort. And in addition to all of the sort of social justice issues that you mentioned, your organization also has a big focus on the arts and culture. You do a street fair, you have a cultural cafe where you feature artists and musicians and spoken word. Why? So that's a lot, too. So tell us how the arts got to be highlighted and why the arts are seen as so important in addition to issues of health and education and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, arts and culture have really, for the most part, been part and parcel of our work since, again, our incorporation. I mean, many of us have woven artistic expression into our programming or was very much a part of the types of people that we were kind of reaching out to or were a part of our volunteer force. And we simply formalized that as an area of work probably around 4 or 5 years ago and have been more deliberate about developing a full kind of arts and culture department really at the organization. And I mean, the reason we think it's such a critical part of the larger work, and we don't, and again, we try to make certain to draw the connections between the role of art and social justice or arts as part of how we serve the community. So we don't see these as separate, again, siloed areas. But specifically, art and culture become such a critical vehicle for the assertion of a very unique identity. It becomes the bridge within which communities can become connected to one another, becomes a space for discussion of a whole range of issues and relating those issues to the just general, broader community so that they don't get so isolated or quote-unquote Muslim-specific.
Mm-hmm.
So our venues are, very well attended. Our programming, such as Community Cafe, which you alluded to, now has happened for over 6 years, and every other month it brings different artists and performers, poets, and different activists together with scholars. And, we typically will have 400 people who will come from across the country, performers from across the country, specifically for a really inspiring evening. And then every other year, our signature event has, and again, this has been going on since the first year of our incorporation, is an event known as Taking It to the Streets. And that, again, is just a really large vehicle for the assertion of identity that, in the most positive and what we hope is inspiring, affirmative way, where we are, again, bringing now thousands of people to a park once associated with the stoning of Martin Luther King here on the south side of Chicago, and turning it in for at least that day a vision, a symbol of what we think the Muslim community in America could look like as it works in partnership with brothers and sisters in other faith communities for the greater good.
Mm, wow. I want to turn to a frustration for a minute and something that you have said, which is that even though people like yourself, Muslim Americans across this country, are very active in social justice issues across the board, criminal justice, public safety, education reform, all of that and more, that there tends to be a lack of visibility in the public sphere. Your voices aren't always the ones that get heard. Why do you think that is, and how do we fix that?
Well, you know, I think in part it is, you know, the Muslim issue, quote-unquote, as it gets defined, and the Muslim voice is often, especially since 9/11, but even before that, was often really conflated with this larger crisis and the kind of a geopolitical crisis at one point was about foreign policy in the Middle East, and then unfortunately, you know, from 2001 up to this point, larger conversations of terrorism and civil liberties and national security. And so I think, you know, up until that point, the Muslim community was generally still not as well known. It was an invisible community. The larger and much more historical presence of African-American Muslims were not really discussed publicly outside of references occasionally to the Nation of Islam, and as I think most of your listeners know, that really comprises a very small sector of the larger African American Muslim experience. And so, and then after 9/11, so much of the public narrative was fixated with the story predominantly of immigrant Muslims and immigrant Muslims in relationship to, again, issues of national security and civil liberties and the erosion of civil liberties. And, you know, those are important stories, but what happens in that process, it obscures the very real presence of, you know, American Muslims who have been active and in communities for decades doing phenomenal work and very inspiring and often very difficult work of, you know, working coalitions and alliances, addressing housing and criminal justice and the day-to-day issues that not only impact Muslims that are living in these environments, but of course impact, you know, their neighbors. And the inability to identify that work and identify those issues as bona fide Muslim American issues, again, kind of ghettoified the community into this one very narrow slice of kind of the larger picture of the Muslim of the broader American society that we think about. And so that has been frustrating on some levels, but I think increasingly, you know, people have, you know, the way out of that, I think increasingly there's been a you know, a really honest dialogue among, you know, more, I think, responsible both folks in the media and folks within, you know, major institutions to identify those other voices, to bring those types of stories to light, to make sure that in talking about American Muslims or the Muslim community generally, we don't lose sight of that. And so I'm hopeful. I mean, it's certainly, there's still a long way to go before we shift that larger kind of paradigm. But I think increasingly the American public is becoming more familiar with the fact that, you know, we do have a very vibrant, dynamic American Muslim community or Muslims that live with us that are doing great things to try to make this a better place for all of us.
Thank you. I want to go back to the work that you do, which is both, you do a whole lot of different things, but I want to focus just on the community organizing you do and then the policy advocacy you do. And in some ways, those are very connected to each other, but a lot of times they're quite separate. And there are some tensions between them. So, for instance, sometimes when you're doing community organizing, one could be effective at that, but you don't always get your voice heard at the policy levels where decision makers are making decisions. And then likewise, at the policy end, sometimes things go slowly and you have to make compromises and you're representing representing a community, but the urgency of their issues doesn't always get translated into policy, which is on a really different scale. So how do you fit all of that together?
Well, you know, it's a great question. I mean, we really approach policy very much from a community organizing vantage point. And for the most part, I mean, we have, and that distinction is, you know, we start with, we're a grassroots community organization. I mean, we are, our offices are not on the 13th floor of a building downtown. We're right in the community. So we have to be and are held accountable by a base that wants to make sure that they are not only connected to those issues that we are advocating about, that they are helping to lead, if not lead, the actual agenda, that they are educated about those issues. And so we begin at the grassroots and think about how to build power in the community. Community organizers talk about power, and the way in which we build power and we translate that is essentially the ability to act, the ability to move a real grassroots agenda is we talk about how to, you know, identify leaders in the communities who are most affected by those issues, and build a base, connect that base to larger bases in the city, and, you know, form alliances that can then best collectively advance a vision that's in keeping with the grassroots. And often then that could translate into a policy and link up with folks who are thinking about policy more from kind of the policy down perspective, get those policy experts and folks and involved. And I think then you have a real strong, potent mix of kind of the policy wonks with the grassroots community folks, and you could advance a vision for change that is more holistic. And I think that's what we're beginning to see in Chicago and Illinois that really excites us. I mean, for example, tomorrow we are going to be part of a 250-member delegation. We're sending 50 leaders down to Springfield who have been a multi-ethnic, multi-racial delegation of folks who have been working together under the umbrella of this entity called the United Congress of Community and Religious Organizations. Iman was a founding member of this entity along with four or five other prominent community organizations in Chicago. And we are disseminating and distributing the first ever grassroots human rights policy guide for racial equity. And that's, you know, there's 49 pieces of legislation that we've identified, but more importantly, we've identified in there a framework, a grassroots human rights framework that connects issues like education and immigration and criminal justice together, along with national security and you know, housing, so that as communities of color, particularly in the inner city, we don't find ourselves constantly disconnected from one another's issues, or in some cases pitted against one another. So we felt it was critical to advance a unifying framework, and then through that framework, derive a policy agenda. And so, you know, we've been able to arrive at a very strong policy vantage point. I mean, we have this in Illinois, we have the cell phones for many of our legislators. And when we go down to Springfield, they see us, they see the American Muslim community. We're not strangers to them. And more importantly, they don't see us in isolation. When we come down with the Black Church, we come down with Latino community groups, and they know that our voice is part of a larger collective set of voices. And so they have to take us seriously. And that helps to really change the way in which we engage kind of politics here in the state. And it's not just at one level or the other. And I think that's what makes the type of work that we do really inspiring and important and something that I think people get excited by when they're part of it.
Wow, it does sound exciting. Speaking of exciting, and speaking of a project, another new project you're doing that connects so many things, that connects working with other organizations, arts and culture, social justice, and all of that, is this new project that you're doing called One Chicago, One Nation. Can you just talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, that is something that again is really speaks to a lot of the work that Iman has been involved in, and it's actually done in collaboration with another nonprofit organization that has a pretty wide, you know, nationwide and international kind of following here, the Interfaith Youth Corps, which is based here in Chicago with Ibu Patel. But we also are doing this in collaboration with some major philanthropic partners, the Chicago Community Trust and One Nation, which is based in Seattle. And essentially, the project, again, is a real creative initiative that seeks to provide a real broad space for connections through movie making, through a series of kind of community ambassadors, kind of this process of actually developing leaders through a training that both has been developed by the Interfaith Youth Corps and Iman and some of the other partners to create a kind of generation of not just interfaith, but kind of community activist leaders who see not just the connections between the communities, but learn how to make those connections real and translate them into projects that can actually have a lasting effect. So the other part of One Chicago, One Nation is the a series of mini grants that are given to different partners across the city who collaborate, $10,000 grants, which we are able to dispense to, again, those who submit the most dynamic and compelling projects. The film contest, as I mentioned, has probably, I think, upwards to $25,000 in rewards and the opportunity to have your film judged by some very prominent folks like Danny Glover and others in the industry. So it's a project that, again, has brought together some major institutional players along with some grassroots folks to, again, make connections, to advocate for a vision that is united around a change and united around, you know, creating better societies.
Wow. I want to ask you a personal question, Rami, which is, how did you come to do this work? What led you to where you are?
Well, it probably just wasn't one or two things. I think for me, you know, I kind of grew up the son of a two parents who were very much shaped by the conflict in the Middle East. My mother was born in May of 1948, and you know, she was actually born while fleeing from her village. Her mother gave birth to her while fleeing, and they were one of the first actually refugees to come to the southwest side of Chicago. So my mom grew up on the southwest side. My father was from Jerusalem and passed around 5 years ago, but also very intensely shaped by the politics of that region, and was working as a delegate for the Jordanian embassy for a long time in different parts of the world. And so I kind of they divorced at a young age, but I grew up very much informed by both of their experiences and very nomadically until I finally came back to the United States to live and go to school when I was 18 or 19. And again, I was here in Chicago and have been here for the most part ever since. But immediately, I think I was struck by something that I had never really lived through and experienced, and that was, confronting a city that was both very exciting and inspiring to live in, but was also very segregated and ethnically divided into communities, and race was very much part of that. And so I spent a lot of my time trying to wrap my mind around that and befriended some very, seasoned community activists who kind of had been part of making connections between, you know, the challenges for the African-American and Latino communities. And they helped really become mentors for me in understanding that. And most importantly, inspiring me with the vision that, you know, the way to address that is not just by philosophizing about it, but thinking about how to get out into the community, how to think about an activism that is both idealistic but also very pragmatic. And Chicago is a great incubator for me in that sense. I mean, Chicago has an extraordinarily rich history of community activism and organizing, you know, from Jane Addams to Saul Alinsky to the story of the Black Panthers and everyone in between, and not least of which, of course, the story of Barack Obama and his organizing on the south side of Chicago. So being in Chicago, you know, there's something in the water here. I think, lent itself towards that type of trajectory. I never intended, I think, to be involved in the work as long as I I was an English major and international studies double major, and I was thinking more about, you know, again, you know, things that would probably land me into more of an international kind of policy context. But I ended up very much in the community and have been here since, and that also in part informed my decision later on to then pursue a PhD in sociology and urban ethnography and stuff at the University of Chicago. So both my intellectual and academic pursuits and my community organizing have been very much grounded in the experience of, you know, thinking about what it means to be Muslim on the south side of Chicago. Mm-hmm.
Chicago, I think, is quite lucky to have you in your good work. I just have one final question for you, Rami. And you know, as you read the headlines and walk the streets of your neighborhood, it's quite clear that this is a very discouraging and hard time for many, many people, economically, politically, in many ways. And when you look at that and see how hard you work and how difficult things are, what gives you hope?
It's a good question, and I should admit, I mean, there are days that walk is more difficult than others. And, you know, as you mentioned, not only do you sometimes have to contend as an American Muslim or a Muslim with some of the kind of the headlines about the way in which Muslims still, unfortunately, are being framed in terms of the media context and the way in which I think others still have to rely on when they are relying on that 30-second soundbite, oftentimes not a good soundbite. But on top of that, for people who are working in a kind of context like we are here at Iman, I mean, you're talking about foreclosures and abandonment and violence and issues that in the last couple of years have really taken a toll on communities. You know, sometimes that can be a very depressing outcome. I think what continues to give me hope and what has always given me hope is the opportunities that come along with this type of work, and that is really the people who themselves are just, you know, you come across just extraordinary individuals that in spite of all the circumstances are very inspired, are inspiring, and very transformative. And I think that's also part of the larger story about Islam in America that continues to inspire me and that I continue to feel has not been best understood, is that, you know, there's still a lot of concern and anxiety about can you trust the Muslims in America? And, you know, for many of us, the type of stories that we see are the ones of stories of transformation, stories of inspiration, people who have transcended the difficulties of their circumstances, have found ways to give back to the community, have found ways to be as optimistic and positive as you can possibly be in some of the more difficult environments. And it's those individuals, whether they're Muslim, whether they're Jewish, whether they're Christian, and we are lucky on the southwest side of Chicago to have the types of relationships with all three of those communities in very real, organic ways that lends us with the type of, you know, inspiration and hope that this work is and ultimately will have an effect on making, again, this a better community and better country for all of us.
Well, Rami, thank you so, so much for the work that you do, and thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.